You're listening to the 10X Your Agency podcast, where every Wednesday for the next 12 weeks, you'll be learning strategies on how to scale up your agency and grow your client base from successful agency owners who've been there, done it, and built a highly successful agency. You'll learn how they attract clients, what their biggest causes of client churn were, and what their challenges were at different stages of building their agency. My name is Marcus Taylor, and I'll be your host. Hey guys, welcome to episode 2 of the 10X Your Agency podcast. Today we've got a really special guest, Tim Morgan, who's the CEO of Mint Digital, a really fascinating agency that, in addition to having worked with some really impressive brands like Goldman Sachs, the BBC, Tesco's, have also built over 64 of their own startups with a team of just 18 people. Now, collectively, these startups have generated returns 10 times higher than the average European VC. So we're going to learn how Tim has done this, how he balances client services work with building over 64 of their own startups, as well as many lessons around hiring, scaling up a team, and as well as how Mint Digital acquired their first big clients. So Tim, it's a huge pleasure to have you here on the show. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, and thanks for having me on.
Before we dive in, I was just wondering if you could maybe explain a little bit about what Mint Digital is and how it came about.
Mint Digital is a startup studio. I'll probably come back to that a little later. It kind of means that we have a client services business where we build technology products for clients that range from Goldman Sachs, the BBC, Tesco. But then, as well as having that client services business, we also conceive of and build our own products or startups. And in that area, we have built and exited two. We have what we call spun out, where we raise venture capital into another two, so they become separate entities. And yeah, the reason I sort of said I'll come back to Startup Studio, that's now called the Startup Studio. Mint is so old that when we started doing that, there was no word for it. So we've adopted the phrase because that's what people started calling what we were kind of already doing. Mint started when a friend of mine, who I'd known since I was 18, I met him at university, came and had lunch with me one day and said, I want to start a company and I want to make internet hits, is what he said at the start. And at the time, I wasn't too sure what internet hits meant, but I knew I wanted to work with him. And so I kind of said yes. And from that moment on, we started building web and mobile apps, mostly focused in the broadcast sector. So we were very early in kind of second screen entertainment, I suppose. And then from there, we started building our own products and services as well.
Fantastic. So many agencies that I've kind of spoken to over the years, they aspire to kind of reach this point that it sounds like Mint Digital has got to, where they're kind of building their own projects to reduce the dependence on their client base. And you guys have obviously done this very, very well, having built, I think you said, 64 of your own startups. Can you talk us through kind of some of the strategies that you've used at Mint Digital, particularly going back to the early days, on how you kind of ensured that you always had time to focus on these kind of building these kind of startups and ventures and not get bogged down in the client work?
Yeah, so I mean, we never set out, like, our motivation was never to reduce our dependency on client services work. Our interest was twofold. Number one, we were 5 people in a small, cheap office in South London who had big ideas, but like lots of people who've run agencies will know, if you're a small company, it's quite hard to persuade a large client to do something, especially with unproven or new technology, which at the time actually was, we were very early in kind of Ruby on Rails. So we were using Rails from about 2006. And at the time, that like most clients or potential clients loved meeting us and loved our enthusiasm and our ideas, but it's kind of like we were too risky to a point to actually take on meaningful work. So our motivation was kind of twofold. First, from an intellectual perspective, you've got your client base saying, I like you guys and I like the sound of what you're saying, but I can't really kind of commission it. So then from an intellectual perspective, our only option is to build it ourselves using the technologies we wanted to build. So that's kind of like a curiosity side of things, in that it's quite hard to be told by someone else what your interests are, and if there's no market for what you're interested in, I think you've got no choice but to do it anyway on your own back. The second thing was then the things that we built became examples of how and why it worked. So one of the first things we built was very successful in a very short space of time. So suddenly we could go back to the same people and say, this thing that you weren't ready to commission 4 months ago because there weren't enough real life examples of it in the world to show that it was possible, scalable, stable. Well, now I can show you exactly that it is possible, scalable, and stable because I've built this thing and I've got hundreds of thousands of users. So that was our motivation. And I think that's an important distinction because I'm not sure we would have come to the same place had our starting point be how would I become less dependent upon client fees. And then the second part of your question is how you don't get bogged down in client work. I mean, I'd say that I believe if you're going to do like this sort of startup studio model, you have to focus on your client services work. It's the thing that creates a stable, enjoyable place to work from which you can venture. So I don't really agree with the notion of being bogged down by client work. You have to concentrate on it, actually, to the extent that I don't think you're going to be in a good position to be able to build your own products unless you've got a good client services business. So, and then to answer the question more specifically, like we were never so successful at sales. We've never had salespeople at Mint. So we were never so successful at sales that our client work took up all of our time. I mean, that's the truth. We weren't effective enough at finding work to ensure that we were occupied 100% of our time. So then it just becomes a question, well, what do I do when I'm not working on client work? And that's where it all came from.
Do any of your ventures kind of come from the work that you're doing for clients? Like, have you kind of had any experiences where the problems that you've identified through working with the clients, has that kind of fueled some of the ventures you've created?
Yes, definitely. So I'll give you an example. So we were also very early into like real-time, like push technology. We went out again into like the broadcast world, trying to find people who would, what we wanted to do was to make like play-along games so that you could have like a studio-based TV quiz and people at home would be playing along with no latency so that the host of the TV quiz could say in real time, that question I just asked, 44% of the population answered it correctly with no latency, or even 23% of police officers answered it correctly and 19% of students answered it correctly, or the north beats the south, or whatever. So we actually been working with the technology first. We then went out to the broadcast and said, "Wants this form of second screen entertainment?" And actually, again, the answer was kind of like nobody. But what we did learn from like kind of speaking to the market was that eventually led us to create a real-time football game that became a company called Pick Live that span out of Mint and that we sold in 2012. So in that case, I think if we hadn't been active in the broadcast sector, we wouldn't have found the application of the real-time technology to effectively live sports broadcast. I think it would have been very difficult had we not been operating our client services work in that industry. So that's an example of where I'm not sure we would have got to the same place had we not like been out and about. But probably more often than not, there is no kind of direct link. I think one of the great benefits where they can cross over is more around the familiarity of people working together, like having run a startup. One of the hard things, and by that I mean a startup other than Mint, one of the hard things is getting talent and making sure it gels and all the rest of it. And I think people who are talented and are used to working together are kind of mildly irresistible in terms of the ability to make progress and just to avoid the same sort of mistakes that first-time startup founders might make over and over again. So, yeah, I believe that there's a big crossover between the two sides, but it's not necessarily, I was working on client X and I noticed problem Y and then I came back to the office and solved it myself. It's not quite as like linear as that.
So you mentioned that over the years you've been able to work with brands like Tesco's, Goldman Sachs, BBC. First of all, how did you land that first big client? And secondly, now that you're kind of, I think you mentioned you're, is it 12 years into Mint now?
Yeah.
How do you sort of decide what a good client is? And probably more importantly, what kind of clients you typically avoid?
So yeah, so the first big client, I mean, this is a classic reason, going back to what I said earlier about why I think all agencies should develop their own product. So the first big client saw a product that we'd made in the market. So we made something called Islandu, which was a social network in about 2006, maybe 2007. And that was our first, I suppose, venture that we'd made off our own bat. it received a lot of attention throughout the world. It was one of the fastest growing social networks in the world. It very quickly, within a matter of weeks, had tens of thousands of users who were very active. It made page three of the Financial Times. And so going back to an agency with no salespeople or marketing skills to speak of, it's kind of like the best calling card. So Disney, on the west coast of America, where we're not, by the way, saw this because it had been covered by Mashable, it had been covered in all manner of press, came to us and said, like, we think what you do is really cool. How about, you know, we work together? So for us, that's how integral, I suppose, building our own products has been to making that step to sort of having more significant clients. And then in terms of like what we're kind of like looking for now, I think you learn, to be fair. Like, I don't think we've always had the same idea as to exactly what we're looking for. So a lot of it is sometimes things just don't feel right. But then if I was to try and sort of be a bit more prescriptive than that, I think, you know, at Mint, we do want to make a difference. And so that has two impacts in terms of client selection. Number one is what they are contemplating or what they want to achieve fundamentally a kind of net positive to the world? And second, are they intent on doing it? So like, we like to spend our time making progress, developing products, acquiring customers, not necessarily jumping through like decision-making hoops. And so for us, one of the important things is this client actually determined to do something? Because we want to make progress. It's much more satisfying for us if we can identify a problem with them and help them solve it. So I suppose the kind of things we were looking for are, you know, do we feel good about this? Do we actually want to do it? Are they serious about it? And then the third, I mean, frankly, is purely financial, in that I think lots of small agencies especially, but we as well, get contacted by people who kind of say, oh, you know, I've got this idea. Will you build it for me? And I'm going to raise money in 3 months. And, you know, Mint takes enough risk on its own products not to take risk on other people's. So, yeah, those are the kind of criteria. I would say, though, Marcus, it's a very kind of soft thing in that it's a feeling as much as anything.
And when you're working with, let's say, like a big company like Goldman or a company like Tesco's, these companies being so massive, and I presume you're kind of building some kind of startup or some kind of new element to what they're doing. Does it kind of operate almost like, are you familiar with the Skunk Works concept?
Yeah, I'm familiar with the concept. I wouldn't say it's exactly like that. And I do think that actually often we work in slightly different kind of circumstances. So yes, we do work on new products. Sometimes though, we do work on improving existing ones. So yeah, if we think we can help someone, I don't know, just get a better ROI on something that they're doing, then we do. I mean, in some cases, it's more kind of digital transformation, about sort of taking something that needs to be kind of brought up into a kind of digital age. So, and sometimes it's pure team augmentation, like that definitely happens. And sometimes we even work with like funded startups on that front, where they just want 3 weeks of accelerated development in a certain area that they've identified entirely themselves without necessarily having to expand their team. So yes, I wouldn't say, you know, we're kind of Skunk Works. We'd certainly never use that word. But I do think that our pedigree is probably in building highly disruptive digital products, because that's, I suppose that's again where the kind of the venture side of things comes into it. Is, I mean, that's kind of the essence of venture. You're building something from nothing. And, you know, that's something that Mint has a lot of experience of doing.
And so, Tim, I read in one of the interviews that you did, I think it was possibly with Hiscox, you said, at Mint, we're all execution with very little presentation. I read on your website that at Mint, we do rather than talk, acknowledging that Mint's contribution to the kind of the thought leadership surplus is very low. Can you maybe kind of explain some of the thinking behind that, and perhaps what impact that stance on thought leadership has had for Mint when it comes particularly to acquiring new clients?
I mean, it's basically born out of a sense that time is precious. It's the most precious commodity that we have. And so, I mean, I'll give you a quick example, a completely made up example, but say if we were working on some drone technology. Now, drone technology has been around for years. It's obviously become very popular to speculate about the future of the world and how it pertains to drone technology. Now, if you're in my shoes or somebody like me and you're interested in that area, you could write future-facing blog posts about what you think will happen. You can spend a lot of time speculating as to what's going to happen in the industry or making sense of things that other people have said. But ultimately, sometimes that time is better off spent finding out for yourself. Mm. And so that notion is born out of there's absolutely nothing in the world of technology that you are better off learning secondhand than first. So if that makes any sense, maybe too many negatives. Yeah. But ultimately, you learn so much more by actually doing something, even if it's a catastrophic failure, even if it doesn't make any sense at all with hindsight. Mm. You will learn faster and be more qualified to either go again or to help someone else achieve it than you would if you became a kind of thought leader. So that's kind of what I mean by that, in that we much prefer to do than to talk. Now, in terms of the second part of the question, which is how does it affect our client winning ability? Probably negatively. I mean, I've certainly been in pitch situations where the thing that the client or potential client wants is very similar to something that I can, from top to bottom, demonstrate that I have built because I've done it myself. It's sort of congruent to one of the ventures that we've done, for example. But I've lost the pitch because a competitor is more convincing on the thought leadership side. And I think, unfortunately, the way that digital agency work is bought in the market, I don't always think that the sort of the company that's most suitable for the job wins the pitch. I think presentation is actually disproportionately weighted in the digital agency business. And so I'd say that policy or theory or mantra about doing rather than kind of talking doesn't necessarily help in terms of winning new business. And I don't get me wrong, I'm not bitter about that. That's life. But I would say that from the client's perspective, like very often Mint, I'd say maybe as much as a quarter of our work is coming into a situation where someone else hasn't delivered what was expected of them. And I do think anyone contemplating buying digital services should, you know, everyone that they're considering appointing, they should ask, you know, I want to see something in the real world that you've built that demonstrates you're capable of doing this. And that isn't a mock-up, that isn't a presentation or a proposal. That is something that people are using every day because, you know, there's no barriers to entry to building stuff on the internet. You can do it in your spare time. You can do it cheaply these days. And, you know, if I was in their shoes, I'd want to see evidence that this person, A, cares about the problem, and B, has solved a similar problem themselves in the past. Because I don't think there's any reason or kind of excuse not to at least try it. Doesn't obviously mean you're going to have a perfect match in terms of what the client's trying to do and what the digital agency's trying to do, but there should be something. Like, I wouldn't hire a writer at Mint if they couldn't point to something on the internet that they'd written.
So it's kind of a bit of a trade-off in terms of sales for, I suppose, the way the operations are run. It has perhaps a bit of a negative impact on sales. But I suppose also within that, there's kind of a, as you kind of touched on, like a positioning element to it. Like when I was kind of reading the Mint Digital website, it's so different to how most agencies try to position themselves that I imagine it kind of has almost that nice impact on attracting a different kind of client, or a client, as you say, that has perhaps gone through some bad situations with a previous agency that, you know, perhaps were very guru-like and, you know, thought leaders. So have you noticed that kind of effect coming through?
Yeah, I have. And that is very rewarding from my shoes, I suppose, because it feels like we're useful and we're helping people. And it means that we have good relations with our client. It means that our attention is very good, because it's like anything in a relationship. You don't know on day one what someone's like. There's one thing I kind of wish actually would happen. Very often in a digital agency space, a client will hire a digital agency for the first time to do a big job. If it works, over time, they might give them more smaller jobs, maintenance or product development. But kind of in a way, it's the wrong way around, in that it would be better if you could get used to working with someone when the stakes are lower. And if it works out really well, give increasingly large work only if it's working out, which is kind of how the real startup community works. So, yeah, I mean, I can't wave a magic wand. The way digital services are bought has been this way for as long as I can remember. And I can't change it on my own. But it's refreshing to hear what you've just said. And, yeah, I like to think the most important test is, am I satisfied? Or when I say I, are we satisfied, meaning everyone at Mint, that we're providing value for money, that we're solving real problems, and that we're making progress. Because if we're not, then we're not going to be happy with ourselves. And it's important to us that we are.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, Tim, I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the team. So how many people are in the current Mint team?
So there's around 18 in the team at the moment.
Can you talk us through some of kind of your philosophies around building the team? And is there sort of any intention around keeping the team deliberately smaller? Or 18 people, that's relatively small for an agency that's working with, you know, the kind of clients that you guys have.
Yes. And so, I mean, there's two things to have in mind here. Number one is the size of our team actually fluctuates according to some of our ventures. So one of the hard things about the startup studio model is that you're continually breaking up the band. Depending on a certain point in our cycle, we lose people to our own startups if they get funded, if that makes sense. I've left Mint to run one of our startups for 2 years and then come back. So I kind of know what that's like. So we have been bigger than we are. But if we were 100 people, there's two things I think become hard. First is to ensure quality or consistency. And the second is being easy to maneuver. Mm. It's good to be able to make decisions quickly. It's good to be able to turn down clients because you're either not appropriate for the work because you just know that they're looking for some skills that you don't have, or you don't want to work with them, going back to one of your earlier questions, for some other reason, rather than have what I would describe as the sort of treadmill effect, which is I'm now on the treadmill's moving faster, which means that my life becomes increasingly kind of panicked and anxiety driven, and it means that I'm a little looser around some of my principles than I otherwise would be.
Yeah.
So it is by design. Now, all that to say, that doesn't mean that we don't hire, and in certain circumstances we would do so. But yes, I think it's harder probably to do our model at a much bigger scale than at our size. Actually, at a bigger scale, you could conceivably get so big that you generate enough cash that you can venture, but then you're kind of, it's more like asset management. You're really repurposing cash, not thoughts, skills, and people. Mm. In that you could use your balance sheet just to become a kind of a quasi-angel investor. But that's a slightly different thing to what we do.
So when you say 18 people on the team, is that just Mint Digital? That's not including the startups that have kind of spun out of or been acquired from Mint?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, and in terms of your, I mean, what are your kind of processes or philosophies around what you look for when you're hiring at Mint?
Step one is always around competence. We have extremely rigorous entry criteria, like and generally real tests. But that's code reviews, might spend some time solving a problem with a candidate. But yeah, so we do have quite a kind of hands-on and thorough recruitment policy kind of around competence. And because we're quite a small group, we don't have like a written policy around this, but it'd be unlikely that anyone would be hired at Mint if one person who'd met them in the recruitment process was a kind of no hire. Mm. So the first thing is kind of competence. And then other than that, you know, I think willingness and inclination is really underrated. It's probably harder to measure than competence, but it might be more important than competence, other than extreme forms of incompetence, by the way. But on the basis that everyone gets to a certain level of competence, or the most candidates do, then yeah, willingness and inclination, in that what we do is hard, but we have a much greater chance of success if the team is inclined and curious and experimental and hardworking and, you know, a lot of those kind of other skills. So we do look for those things too. I mean, I like to think that we also have a pretty good culture, in that I'd never advertise this because it's the sort of thing you could never say, but most people, having worked with us, say that one of the most remarkable things about us is that we're nice. And I don't really know exactly what to do with that, but I think we want to maintain that. It's very important to us that we like not just most of the people we work with, but all of the people that we work with, because there's not that many of us and we all have to work together.
Yeah. So Tim, before we move over to doing a couple of quick fire questions to wrap things up, I read somewhere that Mint's investment in building the 64 startups has generated returns that are 10 times higher than the average European VC. Can you maybe kind of deconstruct that a little bit?
Yeah, so we've been building our own startups for 8 years. At the time that we did the calculation, it was approaching Christmas, so I was working from home. And historically, people have either sort of said, "Oh, you know, I love some of the startups that you guys have built," or they've never heard of any of the startups that we've built. That happens as well, and that's kind of all fine. But the conversation from then goes on around the kind of the merits of those startups from a kind of, I don't know, like an interesting or interestingness or subjective kind of thing. And that's fine. But then there's a different type of conversation, which occasionally people have asked, which is like, well, you know, how much money have you made out of it? How well does it do? And we'd never really sat down and calculated what our investment in them was and what our returns were. So I thought it was a good thing to do. So we basically added up all of the time and money that we'd spent, and then we looked at return. And return in our world is like, we've created profitable startups that never raised venture capital. So the return is a combination of the contribution that kind of comes back to the mothership, if you like, plus any exits you might get. So it's sort of slightly different from how a VC would calculate return, because the profits of a portfolio company in a VC don't go to the VC unless it pays a dividend, which is unusual. So it's a kind of matrix for calculating what our returns were. And then just to do an IRR calculation and then to compare it versus like benchmark European venture capital, which as an asset class, the benchmarks are occasionally published so that you can kind of see how you're doing. And we found that our returns were 10 times higher than the average European venture capitalist. Now, there's a lot of caveats that go with that, Marcus. So number one, we haven't deployed anything like as much capital. So you could argue that if we got lucky once early, then it's kind of disproportionate. And also in some cases, like we mark our investments to market, which means that if a company spun out of Mint, we'll take the valuation at the last round of financing, which is exactly how VCs do it too. But again, there's still risk in terms of all of those investments haven't gone through a cycle or reached exit or anything like that yet. But yeah, that's what we did.
I mean, that's an incredible achievement and, you know, such a great thing to achieve. The second thing I was wondering is kind of how that actually works. So, you know, in terms of from the team's perspective, having these 64 startups, I mean, let's kind of go through a scenario. Let's say I were to join Mint Digital tomorrow. What does it look like in terms of putting those ventures together? You know, for new people joining the team, can they kind of work on their own ventures, or do they join an existing team, or at any one time do you have kind of multiple ventures, or is everyone kind of working on? I know that's kind of a couple of questions in one, but I just kind of want to get a feel for sort of what is the internal kind of process for how you put these ventures together and then get them out into the real world.
The answer isn't kind of clean cut. So if we take the scenario, like, so because the missing data points are, if you joined, was there something you wanted to work on that was potentially interesting to Mint, would be question number one, right? So in most cases, like in the past, we've tried to like manufacture ideas and with kind of mixed results, I would say. So, you know, I think that it goes back to inclination. Like if there's something that you're genuinely interested in and you really want to solve a problem. So if you were in that instance, then there is every chance that on the basis that enough other people at Mint agreed with you or certain individuals at Mint agreed with you, you would be allowed to at least explore that venture. But of course, for most people, most of the time, that isn't the case. Mm. And so we have this notion at Mint of a venture being on, and that's the word we use. And if a venture is on, that means that it's kind of established that we'll be working on it. But it could be a new one, or it could be an existing one. Now, as time goes by, you learn more and more about what you're doing as time goes by. And in the seed stage, the earlier stage, it is much more a feeling than anything that can be defined in metrics. Metrics help, data helps, no question. But sometimes the question isn't, am I making £100,000 a week in revenue? The question is, do I feel more or less confident this week than I did last week? What have I done to improve this product and how is it being received? What's my view on the size of the market, having now worked in that market for the last 2 months? Is it what I thought it was? Like, let's go back to the thesis that we started with when we started talking about whatever the venture is, Venture X. And how do we feel about that now that we actually have more data? Again, unlike traditional startups, we don't have, like, we fund these things almost by a drip based on a feeling at the time. rather than like very large intervals, which is, okay, here's money for 18 months, come back. And if it looks rosy, we'll give you Series A. So it is soft. But to answer some of the sort of specific questions that you asked, yes, it's completely conceivable we would be working on more than one thing at once. Although I would say if something looks like it's really on, and obviously there's no like onometer, but if you can imagine it, if something like every week you worked on it, it just seemed to get better and everyone was enthusiastic and you were being positively surprised or not surprised, even better, but everything was going positive, then I do think that in a world like Mint has limited resources, I'm not sitting on a massive balance sheet. So really and truly what we need to do at that point is to start focusing on the one that we think has the kind of best chance. But that creates a lot of problems because, you know, you find yourself having to, you know, kill ideas or say no to ideas. And again, comparing it to the traditional venture capital market, if a venture capitalist says no to an entrepreneur, they never have to see each other again. In our world, we have to work together the next day. And so culturally, it's a completely kind of separate and different model. But I would say this, in that there is no real process, in that we change our process as often as we find bugs in it. And the feeling to us is much more important than any particular gate or metric or you know, defined path to doing this. Again, going back to venture capital as an asset class, Mint has better IRR than average European venture capital. I could almost certainly bet that it doesn't have better IRR than the best European venture capitalist, probably nothing close to it. So there is an element of art and not science in this area, and there's obviously a lot of science too, but I think a kind of healthy appreciation that it's a combination of both is the sort of best approach.
Before we go on, if you're looking to grow your client base and capture more leads for your agency, then I'd recommend checking out LeadFormly. LeadFormly is a lead generation tool run by yours truly that enables you to upgrade the forms on your website to conversion optimized forms that are going to increase your conversion rate and help you capture more qualified leads from your website. Using LeadFormly, we've seen agencies capture up to 700% more leads. So if you're interested in giving it a try, we have a 14-day free trial that you can check out at leadformly.com. That's LeadFormly.com. Once again, that's at leadformly.com. Okay, Tim. So what I want to do now is kind of, as we wrap up, go through five quick fire questions. So just some real kind of quick questions. So the first question I have for you is, what is your number one book recommendation that you would recommend to other agency owners?
That's hard because I haven't particularly read many books that are sort of aimed at agency owners. But the one I would say anyone who runs a business, whether it's an agency or not, should read is Give and Take by Adam Grant. Yeah, I'd highly recommend that. I can tell you why if you want.
Go on, give us a reason.
Well, I'm giving it. The sort of typical historic worldview is that if you're generous in business, you get taken advantage of. And Give and Take is really about how you can be generous, and not only does it not decrease your chances of success, it increases them, but with some important caveats. So I'll recommend you read the book.
Awesome. What are two of your favorite tools that you use at Mint?
Two. So Slack, and it's not particularly new, but it's transformational as a tool. So yeah, I love Slack. It's not really a tool, but we started working with Elixir recently, which has opened up some opportunities or new way of thinking within Mint. So yeah, Slack, Elixir.
Awesome. And what is one piece of advice that you would give to a business owner or agency owner who's looking to go from six figures annual revenue up to seven?
Provide value for money. Don't take on engagements for any reason other than you think you can really help the client, and at the end, they will be delighted and punch in the air that they hired you. If you don't think that's what's going to happen, then I think you might be making a rod for your own back. You'll find retention very hard. So you need to really believe that you are the best person for that job.
Got it. And on that note, what have you kind of noticed are some of the biggest causes of client churn for agencies?
There's two that spring to mind. Number one is that very often agencies solve too specific a problem. So they're not really aware enough or across their clients' entire strategic goals, which means that when the very specific problem has been solved, there's no work for the agency to do. I think in the new age, digital agencies should try and help their clients succeed. That's normally to help them grow. But to do that effectively, you need to know at the very top level what the client's trying to achieve, not just the sort of detail of a very specific piece of work. So I think that's one thing, in that once they've had their use, they're sort of shown the door, because it's not obvious to the client how they could be helpful in future. The second thing is there's a lot of movement of sort of human capital within decision-making jobs at clients. The sort of digital area is an area where the job market is very fluid. And so I think a lot of people, there might be a new chief marketing officer joins a company, and I think sometimes the agency could potentially be shown the door because the CMO, who now has the decision-making ability, wants to work with someone they've worked with before, almost regardless of what the incumbent has ever done. You know, there's nothing that digital agencies can do about that other than trying to discourage their key clients from leaving.
Cool. And last question is, what's next for Mint Digital?
We've got some exciting new ventures. So we're working on an AI-based venture, which we've kind of got working internally but haven't shown the world yet. We're all excited about that. Maybe a fund. If you look at what we do, generally digital agency work doesn't attract very high margins. So your ability to generate large amounts of cash with which to build new ventures is limited. And I have, and I think maybe even in the piece about our IRR and how good it is, I do wonder what would happen if we had more money, because we'd be able to make bigger bets and bets on more things.
Got it. Awesome. Well, it's time to wrap up, Tim. So I just want to say a huge thank you for your time and for sharing all these insights with us. It's been really, really fascinating having you here. If people want to learn a bit more about you or Mint Digital, what's the best way for them to find out a little bit more?
Go to the website or email me, I guess, tim@mintdigital.com, and I'll tell them all about it.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, Tim.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the 10X Your Agency podcast. If you're interested in acquiring more leads for your business, I'd like to invite you to a free webinar that I'll be hosting on how to acquire 300% more leads from your website without increasing your traffic. In this webinar, I'll be sharing how you can turn your website into a lead generation machine, 4 strategies on how you can boost your form submissions by 300%, and much more. So if you're interested, all you need to do is go to Google, type in lead formally, acquire more leads. That's lead formally, spelled LEADFORMLY, acquire more leads. And the landing page to register for the webinar should appear at the top. As I said, it's completely free, and we run this webinar every single week. So once again, thanks for listening to this week's episode, and stay tuned for next week's episode of the 10X Your Agency podcast.